This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Our quote today from Ben Franklin: a slip of the foot you may soon recover, but a slip of the tongue you may never get over. Mercury's retrograde, be careful. Anyhow, got up this morning and found a voicemail on my phone system from last night that somehow we missed, inviting me to be on Hannity and Combs. Thank God I didn't do it. Anyway, oh, what strange times. In our second hour today, speaking of slips of the tongue, we're going to ask the question, has Cindy Sheehan, a friend, I mean, I wrote the introduction to one of her books, has Cindy Sheehan become what may be one of the greatest assets to the Republican Party? In our third hour, Peter Phillips is with us with Project Censored, professor of sociology at Sonoma State University and director of the Project Censored Project. I just won first prize in that, but it's not going to be about that. We're going to be talking about health care in the United States. Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress will be with us. And Matt Stoller, political activist and blogger, openleft.com, and Nancy Scola, the blogger over at Air America, talking about what's happening on the internets, what's out there on the tubes, not the trucks. Speaking of what's going on the internets, the conservative news service, what used to be called a conservative news service, now it's called the Cybercast News Service, CNSnews.com, has a new editor, Terrence Jeffrey. And Terrence is with us today. Hey, Terrence, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you with us, and congratulations on becoming editor-in-chief over at CNSnews.com.
Well, thank you very much.
You wrote a piece that I find some agreement with, some disagreement with, and it raises some interesting questions about the Chinese government's exquisite concern for a subspecies of cat. Tell us about this.
Right. Well, it's very interesting. Over the past year, the communist regime in Beijing has gone to great efforts, first to try and find if, in fact, there are any South China tigers still alive in the wild, and then secondly, to preserve them. They hadn't seen a single one of these animals out in the woods since 1964. They sent a team of 30 zoologists to this region of western China where they thought they might be. 2 weeks ago, a farmer, in fact, photographed one. They verified this is a real thing, so they've closed down the woods where this tiger is. In the meanwhile, by the way, they had a...
Shades of the spotted owl.
It's like a spot. This is the Chinese version of the spotted owl. They even extracted DNA from some of the 68 examples of this species they have in captivity, just in case they had to clone some down the road. I did write about it in my column, but they even sent an animal to South Africa to be trained how to hunt in the wild if, in fact, they had to set it loose to try and reestablish a population. So this communist government in Beijing is very interested in preserving the habitat of this wild animal, the South Asian tiger.
Right. And at the same time, as you point out in your article, they don't much give a damn about human rights for human beings.
They don't much care about the habitat of human beings. In fact, there's this non-governmental group based in Geneva that monitors what goes on in terms of human housing. It's called the Center on Housing Rights and Eviction. So they put out a report in June, a very disturbing report, that's about what happens when you have mega events like Olympics to poor people in their homes. And they report that 1.5 million people are in the process of being displaced in Beijing, 1.25 million already, due to redevelopment for the Olympic Games.
And well, now that's not unique. I lived in Atlanta when the Olympics came to Atlanta, and a whole lot of people got displaced. Almost all of them poor people, I might add. Atlanta took that as an opportunity to wipe out some of the projects, I guess they're referred to as. And it was a very, very controversial thing, but they did it.
Well,
that's eminent domain.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a good point. In fact, this group also talks about the Atlanta Olympics. They talk about other Olympics. They don't only talk about the Beijing Olympics. It is on a much greater scale in Beijing, and I hope those people in Atlanta had due process, and I hope they got compensation when they were...
They did get compensation because we have the Fifth Amendment, and they don't have that in China. And you know, odds are they're not getting compensation. But all of this, Terrence Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief at Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com, raises the question, or raises a couple of questions. One is, if you're going to condemn China for saving the tiger and not saving their people, and I share that condemnation with you, why don't you also join me in condemning the government, the conservatives in the United States, who want to say we should save species? I mean, it was, after all, Richard Nixon who signed, you know, many of these laws into place, but not save the humans. We have some 10 million children in the United States who literally, during the course of the next 30 days, will not know where their next meal is coming from. And we have children who have no health care insurance, and yet conservatives in the House of Representatives are saying, no, we're going to go along with the president's veto, and we are not going to expand the S-CHIP program.
Well, look, I could agree with you on the strategic end. I think that we as Americans, as a people, each of us individually, have a duty to try and look out for our neighbors. We want to do what we can for children, especially children who are indigent, whose parents aren't actually taking care of them. And I think that should just be a given. Then the question is, legitimate area for debate is, what is the most effective way of doing this? And how do we do this in keeping with abiding values that maintain our liberty? I would argue that when you have a centralized government and a universal plan for the entire nation, such as SHIP is, and when you start drawing in people who are, in fact, already insured with private insurance and middle-class families, what you're doing is creating a kind of collectivist state on a smaller scale, which they already have in Beijing. And once you have that kind of plan, you, in fact, introduce the possibility of exploitation and abuse of innocent people by the government itself.
But I would submit to you that right now those people who have insurance, I am one of them, are being exploited and abused by their corporate insurance companies. And if the government, you know, and I'm serious. I mean, I lived in Germany for a year where they have national single-payer health care.
Right.
And I could call a doctor and be in the office the same day. I never had a problem. And, you know, pharmaceuticals were free, doctor visits were free, everything. It was fabulous. It was extraordinary. Extraordinary health care. We had three kids there. Two of our kids used the medical system. I used the medical system. I went into a hospital once. I went to the doctor's office once. It really worked. And the government, because the government paid the bills, even though these were all private doctors and private hospitals, not for-profit hospitals, but private, because the government paid the bill, and every single person in Germany was a stockholder in that, because they're all, you know, in a democracy, the government is us. The government was answerable to the people. If I call my private health insurance company right now to complain, they laugh at me. I've had them hang up on me.
Well, look, I may agree with you. I'm no friend of the big health insurance companies. I think part of the problem, from my perspective, that we have with the health insurance system in the United States is you have usually two massive corporations dealing with one another. You have the employer of most workers in the United States, some corporate entity run by some guy whose highest good is the pursuit of profit, and he's negotiating your health care plan with some other corporation, namely the health insurance company, whose corporate executives have the highest good of pursuit of profit. And basically, they're both trying to see if they can get the most out of you, the worker, for the smallest amount of money. And I do think that's a problem, but I believe in moving back.
You're going to get fired over a CNS news here, Terrence.
I don't think so. I think the conservative vision, the true one really, is about moving back. You give more autonomy to the individual, and I think that's by creating more of a free market for medicine, not less of a free market. And I think
So you're suggesting we should enforce the antitrust laws.
No, I think ideally a better system would be where most people had health savings accounts, which would be tax-free, and where most of their medical care they paid for directly with cash out of their health savings account, and where they only bought insurance for catastrophic things like hospitalization, major surgery, or if you come down with some serious illness that's going to take protracted treatment, then you have to go to the insurance. But when you have a system where most of the things you do are covered by insurance, first of all, insurance is too exorbitant, and secondly, it breaks down the direct relationship between you and the doctor. The doctor should know you as an individual, as a neighbor, and as a paying customer, not as someone that an insurance company or HMO brings to him and he doesn't have to have personal individual concern for.
Walk down a fairly soft area here. By the way, we just lost our ISDN line. We're on Comrex backup. I'm letting the folks at the studio in New York know. So the bottom line here, you would not support a national health care system. You would not say that health care should be a right in the United States, just like in distinction to how you're suggesting that, you know, human rights should be rights in China.
I don't think you can say that health insurance run by the government or any combine is a right. I think people have a right to life.
Every other industrialized democracy in the world says that.
Yeah, but they're wrong. They're wrong. I think you have a right to life. I think you have a right to be treated as a human being. And I think we have a, every individual has a duty to respect those rights and treat people.
Isn't the right to life the right to health care?
No, those are distinct things. You're not talking about the right to health care. You're talking about the right to a government-run health insurance program, which isn't necessarily going to provide you with health care.
Okay, well, an interesting debate. Terrence Jeffrey, CNSNews.com, the new editor of Cybercast News Service. Terrence, thanks for being with us
today. Hey, thanks for having me.
Good talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, the tickets are on sale over at for our event in Phoenix. This is on November 9th. I'm going to be we're doing a national tour here as Cracking the Code. My new book is now out, and in fact, it's on sale in Phoenix. And you can go over to 1480kphx.com and find information for tickets to the gig I'll be doing there on November 9th. Similarly, on November 5th, we'll be doing a book signing at Powell's Bookstore in Portland. On November 3rd in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at Hastings Books and Book and Music. On October 27th, Sonoma State University, I'll be receiving the first place in the Project Censored Award. We'll be talking later today to Peter Phillips of Project Censored about that. And on the 26th, the Elliott Bay Bookstore in Seattle at 101 South Main at 7:30. So that should be a good time to be had by all. The Wall Street, you know, I guess the question at a certain point is when and where and how do you decide how or if to put a price on everything? Because it really seems to me that there are some things that we just shouldn't be putting a price on in terms of, the marketplace, that instead we should be saying this is something that we need. We need it regardless of what it costs. So we're going to do it right. Our police departments, for example, we don't sit around and say, well, you know, let's cut the police budget in half. We don't want to pay as much taxes this year. Everybody realizes that would be stupid. Oh, let's cut the fire department's budget in half. Let's not repair our roads for 10 years. Well, that's what the Republicans have been doing for 26 years, is not repairing roads, not repairing bridges, not repairing dams. And now we have a $4 trillion infrastructure debt as a consequence of 26 years of ignoring our infrastructure. But this mentality... This mentality has dripped all the way down into the culture, as it were. This from the News of the Weird, I guess. I realize that's a website. This is not from that. This is a story that was in the Oregonian, the Portland paper here. A Wall Street banker responding to an anonymous 25-year-old woman's ad posted on Craigslist describing herself as spectacularly beautiful and superficial, and said she was looking for a husband who makes more than $500,000 a year in New York City. And so he replied, he said, your looks will fade and my money will likely continue into perpetuity. So in economic terms, you are a depreciating asset and I am an earning asset. You're 25 now and will likely stay pretty hot for the next 5 years, but less so each year. Then the fade begins in earnest. By 35, stick a fork in you. Doesn't make good business sense to buy you, which is what you're asking, so I'd rather lease. I mean, is this what we're coming to? This is this pervasive idea in our culture that, well, you know, it's everything can be explained in terms of economics. No, some things have to be explained in terms of values, like human rights, like endangered species. By the way, just following up on some of our conversation yesterday about economics, speaking of economics, today's Financial Times, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, speaking out again. This is a news analysis by Chris Giles and Peter Garnham in today's Financial Times, the UK's version of the Wall Street Journal, and not owned by Rupert Murdoch. The dollar is vulnerable to more falls, they say, in spite of its recent sharp decline. This is according to the International Monetary Fund. So far, the retreat has been orderly. That is the steady decline of the dollar, the steady impoverishment of the United States of America, let us call it, relative to the rest of the world. They point out the dollar's lost 0.3% against the euro yesterday. Went to $1. It now costs $1.42 to buy a euro. I remember when you could buy a euro with 87 cents. In fact, I remember being in Europe when you could buy a euro with 87 cents. The greenback has fallen 5.3% since mid-August. This is mid-October. That's 2 months. That's a substantial drop. It has fallen 16.7% against the euro since the start of 2006. Not just from the beginning of the Bush administration, but from the beginning of 2006. What is this a consequence of? By the way, the IMF frets that a combination of financial turmoil, this is from the Financial Times, and global trade imbalances could bring an end to the party. As a result of the global credit squeeze, the fund reined in its expectations yesterday for most advanced economies. They say the U.S. is only going to grow they cut their growth force by 0.9% to 1.9%. Not a good thing. And they're suggesting that most of the damage being done to the U.S. economy, largely as a result of the housing bubble bursting, or the subprime loan bubble bursting, is going to remain in the United States, but it is happening all over the world. But this is the direct consequence of 26 years of conservative corporatist economic policies. They're coming home to roost. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, that's what happens when Mercury goes retrograde, at least according to my friends who know about such stuff. Strange things happen. It's going to be that way until the first week of November. So, I guess things like, you know, presidents shouldn't talk about nuclear war, World War III. Boy, did George put his foot in his mouth last night. It's almost like this guy doesn't yet realize that he's president of the United States. So it concerns me tremendously. In any case, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, and AirAmerica.com, if you want to participate in our blog, and there's our schedule and other information over there as well. Carolyn in Arizona on the line. Hey, Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, I got the impression from when you were talking to Terry Jeffrey that you're against saving endangered species?
No, I am not at all against saving endangered species. His point was that the Chinese are elevating the saving of endangered species, that they're holding that as a high value, which we do here, and I think it's a good thing. But
well,
that in China,
them,
they're not holding human rights as a high value, and he's condemning them for that. And I share his condemnation of China for that, but I think that we should also look in, you know, before we throw stones, we should look at our own glass house. We're not protecting human rights in the United States. We're not protecting even things like the human right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to life, which is provided for by national health care system.
Well, there's some like you are humanists and defend humans. Some of the rest of us defend animals. Because there's lots of you guys defending lots of human beings, but not a lot of us defending the rights of what we feel should be the rights of saving endangered species and their habitat, the planet.
I believe all life,
areas that are not
Carolyn,
up.
Carolyn, please, you don't know me, and I'm not a humanist. And I believe that all life has rights. And I believe that the rights of all life should be enshrined in our law. I absolutely am there.
Glad to hear that, because I didn't want to have to quit listening to you.
Well, thank you. And by the way, Chris, I am now hearing an echo back in my ears. There, now I'm not. And now I am again, and now I'm not. Okay. Anyhow, Carolyn, but that was my point, is that we, if we're going to be protecting the rights of, now we're back to the commerce, if we're going to be protecting the rights of endangered species and holding that as a value, and we are and we should, then, and the Chinese are, and gee, what a great thing, that we should all collectively be also looking at the rights of human beings. I'm in favor of both.
They displaced an awful lot of people with that Three Gorges Dam.
Oh, hugely. Yeah, I wrote a whole chapter in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, condemning that. And not just a lot of people. They wiped out entire ecosystems. I mean, they created, right, my point. And they created what has now become the world's largest open sewer. It's not a good thing. It's a quite a destructive thing. Carol, I got to move along. Thank you for your call and thank you for your thoughts. I appreciate it. Linda in Manhattan, listening to WRL. Hey, Linda, welcome to the program. Linda, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Linda.
Hello?
You're on the air if you
can. Hello?
Okay, apparently she can't hear me, so let's go to James in Albany. Hey, James. James, you are on the air now. James?
Hello?
Hey, James, you're on the air.
Yes. I was just calling because it seems the conservatives are hypocrites. Because whenever they talk about having high morals, they always want to talk about being pro-life. And then once somebody's born, first thing they worry about is we don't want to have to help them if they need any health care, if their employer doesn't supply it and they don't earn enough to provide it for them and their children.
I absolutely agree, although first of all, let's not paint all conservatives with that broad brush. There are many conservatives who would agree in the sanctity of all life, even non-human life. Some conservatives, but most, at least all life. There are Republicans who are willing to vote for the S-CHIP bill, for example, for the expansion of health insurance to everybody in this country. Or not to everybody,
right.
to the low end of the middle class, basically, is what it is. And, good on them. The tragedy is that ideology is blinding so many of these other guys that they're not able to go, where really we should be going. James, thanks for the call. Richard in Vancouver. Richard, you disagree.
Oh, thank you. I am not sure if you believe it a hardship if parents, lower middle class parents, pay $50 or $100 a month for their children's health insurance.
Well, the last time I looked, health insurance for a family with a couple of kids was around, depending on the kids and depending on the problems they had, but typically was somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 a year rather than $500 a year or $1,000 a year, as you're suggesting.
Well,
have you shopped for insurance recently? I have over the last couple of years. I'll tell you, it's damn expensive stuff these days.
But I want to ask you what the line of thinking is where the parents are a bad influence on the children, and the nation state wants to take the children away. Is that Stalinist Russia, or does it even go before that?
I'm not sure I understand you. Is the question, Richard, should the state have the right to take children away from their parents if they're being abused by their parents?
Well, I think this S-CHIP is to step in that direction, yes.
It's got nothing to do with taking children away from their parents.
But what it does is it takes the children away from their parents' control over their health care.
No, the parents have total control over the children's health care. They just don't have to pay the bill.
No, because the parents have one set of doctors, right? And the family all goes to this one set of doctors. And when the children
not true.
It
you can
true.
Pick your doctors under with the S-CHIP program. With any of these programs, you can pick your doctors. There's a large pool of doctors out there who will take Medicare and Medicaid.
Not all doctors accept the HMOs that the government...
Not 100% of doctors, and that, again, is an indication. See, this is why, Richard, if we were to expand these programs to a national program, if everybody in the United States had health care provided by a single-payer system, a single-payer entity, that being the government, then you would have a constituency, 100% of your constituents, if you were a member of Congress, would have to answer to for these programs. The reason why some of the programs like the Veterans Administration and Medicare are underfunded in the United States is because they represent a minority of Americans, a minority that some members of Congress feel they can ignore because the contributions from that minority or the noisiness of that minority is less than the contributions from and the noisiness of the huge healthcare lobbies.
Well, perhaps I just don't think of taking incremental steps towards a national health care because I like that idea. I do know that the HMOs pay a ridiculous low amount to general practitioners, to maybe to 25% of what they normally charge. The parents pay $10 a copay for a visit, and the HMOs pay $15. And that is way significantly less than what the doctors charge.
Let's have a national single-payer health care program where doctors can make a living. I mean, it works in every other industrialized country in the world where doctors can make a living, hospitals can function, and we're not saying that if you want to be a manufacturer in this company, you're going to have to spend thousands of dollars on health care and add that to the cost of your product. Detroit's being wiped out by this, you know.
Well, they can make a living, but they can't make a comfortable living. I don't know what experience you have with doctors who work in free clinics, but it's not a comfortable life.
In the United States.
In the United States.
Yeah, because we have a for-profit healthcare system. The year that I lived in Germany, one of my friends, Osvein Garrett, Dr. Garrett, was the physician in the program that was attached in the local healthcare center that was attached to the nonprofit that I was doing volunteer work for. And so I'm quite familiar with the German system of medicine and what doctors make. And a doctor in Germany makes the equivalent of probably, well, in today's dollars in the U.S. would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $150,000 to $180,000 a year. And they don't make much more than that top end, and they don't make much less than that bottom end. It's a good upper middle class income. Doctors in the United States can make anywhere from, you know, $50,000-$60,000 a year if they're really, you know, willing to take on a poor population and do the hard work.
Lucky.
Or they can make millions of dollars a year if they become an oncologist or a specialist.
That's why we have most of the doctors who go to school, they go into specialties because the general practitioners make a way lower amount than
I know. It's a broken system, and it's a broken system because it's being driven by profit. And the profit motive should have no play in whether or not somebody gets healthy.
What I hope is that we do eventually move to a single-payer health system, but let's not take incremental steps. Let's just do it and get it.
I don't disagree with you that it would be a great thing to just snap our fingers and go for it. That's what Al Gore has suggested. It's what Dennis Kucinich has suggested. And John Edwards has suggested a program that probably within a few years would get us there quicker than anybody else. But everybody else is talking about incremental systems and, you know, let's keep the health insurance companies around. You know, they're passing out hundreds of millions of dollars in campaign contributions. They have the ability to spend. I mean, look at when Hillary Clinton, Bill and Hillary Clinton proposed it wasn't even a single payer system back in 93, I think it was. The health insurance industry came down on them with over $100 million in advertising nationwide. I mean, boom, right on their heads. We have to do something about that. You know, taking the money out of politics seems like a good start, but I am just strongly of the opinion that healthcare should be part of our commons. That the right to life is literally the right to life. That we should have the right to stay alive if we're hit with a disease that could kill us, and that should be a right that was in our Declaration of Independence. And for that matter, you know, implied in the preamble of the Constitution, and I think that we should join every other industrialized country in the world in agreeing with it. Richard, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
So yesterday was Black Thursday in France. See, in France they know how to do this. And here's why. And this is why conservatives don't want this to happen in the United States. because in France you have a strong middle class that that has strong benefits and job security, and so they feel like they have the freedom to step out into the streets and say, we're not going to take it, you politicians, if you do something we don't like. Whereas in America, you've got people who are so terrified that they will lose their job and thus lose their health benefits and thus might die if they get cancer or something, God forbid, that people are afraid to go out in the streets or too busy. Black Thursday yesterday, 24-hour strike, halted most trains, subways, and buses throughout the country, according to the New York Times, canceled classes in schools, theatrical performances. Only 46 of France's 700 high-speed trains were running. Museums closed. The state-owned gas and electric utility giants joined the walkout, leading to a reduction in electricity output. Sarkozy, the newly elected, 5 months in office. His wife left him officially yesterday. They're divorced, I guess. You know, they must have gone to Vegas or something. I guess you can get a quickie divorce in France because, according to the New York Times today, they are now divorced, not just separated. His wife left him, and the people of the nation are saying, we're with you. In fact, one of the striking protesters in the port city of Le Havre, this from the New York Times, shouted, Cecilia, this is Sarkozy's wife's name, we are like you. We are fed up with Nicolas. See, he is a neoliberal. He is a George Bush-type president, and France is starting to say, oops. Billy in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Billy, welcome to the program.
Hey.
What's up?
Tom?
Yes, sir, you're on the air.
Oh, what an honor it is to talk to you.
Thank you.
I work down here in the insurance industry down here. My brother's a doctor, and my sister is also a health care professional, and all of us basically agree that the system is completely broke. And one of the main reasons is working in this industry, I understand that this is not a true capitalistic system for health care. If it was really truly capitalistic in my state, you would have more than one provider, which is basically this provider that we have here. It provides 95% of the coverage here in the state, but that's really... You know, that's not really part of the problem in here. In our meetings in here, we're still losing on our average about close to, in our last meeting, 2,000 or 3,000 policyholders a month. And in these meetings here, these executives here are, you know, this is probably, I shouldn't tell you, but they're so clueless as to what's going on. And finally, I had to basically bring up to them to the fact that, guys, here's the deal. Our health care premiums are about equal to what these people are paying on their house premiums. And, you know, and with real wages dropping the way they are, then these households are getting to the point to where they're having to choose between their living in their house or paying our bill.
Right, especially when their adjustable rate mortgage adjusts upwards, and now all of a sudden their house payment went up 20%, and they really have no problem. But, Billy, you're saying this is not true capitalism. Let me set you straight, respectfully. That absolutely is the essence of true capitalism. Under true laissez-faire capitalism, the big get bigger, corporations get bigger and bigger and bigger, swallowing up their competitors until there's nothing
right,
left except one corporation.
No, I mean, you're right.
It's not
what
true
really
free enterprise.
If this was run properly, and you know, here the government comes in here and helps us as a corporation by taking out the two biggest problems that we really have. That is, it takes care of old people through Medicare and poor people who couldn't pay us because they don't have the money. It should leave the middle part of America, which is our prime market that has money, for all of us to basically get in there and fight for. But you know, the system completely fails, and, you know, there's a lot of different reasons for it, but one of the reasons that I want to bring up is the fact that in Congress right now, my company has a lobbyist up there, the lawyer has a lobbyist, the doctor has a lobbyist, the drug companies have a lobbyist, the hospitals have a lobbyist, but there's one group of individuals up there that do not have any type of lobbyist since Ralph Nader left.
And that's us.
Righto.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the lobbyists, then that's why we have to be our own lobbyists. That's why I grabbed the URL, callcongress.org.
How do we as individuals, Tom, individual people, are able to get a common, ordinary guy like me able to get to, you know, compete against somebody that's a drug manufacturer lobbyist?
Two ways, Billy. The first is go to callcongress.org and get one of the toll-free numbers for Congress and start calling your member of Congress, your member of the House of Representatives, your two senators, and lobbying them yourself, you know, sending them letters and just, you know, make it a monthly thing that you do. And number two, show up at the local party meetings of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the Green Party, whatever your proclivity may be. Join a political party and start. What you will find is that for example, if you join the local Democratic Party, odds are there's probably not more than 100 people who are actually active in your local party. In many local parties, it's like 8 or 10 people. We've seen some growth. I know here in Portland, you know, sometimes as many as 100 people will show up for a meeting, but it's really rare. It's typically 20, 30 people. And when the member of Congress comes back to talk with his or her constituents, very often, in fact, usually, the first person that they talk to, the first group that they talk to, is the local party. If you join that local party and you get active, your voice gets amplified 100-fold or 1,000-fold. They start taking
you seriously. You're a national treasure, and I can just tell you, you're the first person that actually made me feel not insane.
Well, thank you.
So thank you for what you do.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. Mark in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Mark, we only have a few seconds before we've got to wrap up this hour.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Real quick, do you know what the health benefit packages is for senators and U.S. congressmen?
What is paid for them is basically like high-end union benefits. They can choose from several health care plans. I know Bernie has Blue Cross Blue Shield. And they can just, you know, and Congress pays for the top program through that program. So it's not like some special, unique thing that's exceptional for members of Congress. It's probably, in fact, not as good as what a CEO gets. But that's what they get. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
So Cindy Sheehan yesterday, welcome back, by the way, to the program. Cindy Sheehan yesterday published a piece on commondreams.org. And let me, you know, first put out this caveat. Cindy is a true American hero. Cindy has been through hell and back, both with regard to the loss of her son, something that, it, to me, as the father of three children who are now adults, is unimaginable, and the absolute hell that she has endured with the Reich smearing her and sliming her and threatening her and everything else that she's encountered. I know, you know, what I encounter as a talk show host, it has to be just a tiny fragment of what she's encountered as somebody who's out there, whose public face is out there, who everybody recognizes. I mean, I can walk through an airport, everybody doesn't know who I am. Not true with Cindy Sheehan. And for the rest of her life. So she has done some really important work. And her voice is a very important voice. And that's, frankly, why I'm concerned about this op-ed in Common Dreams. And I'd like to talk with you about it. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on it as well. She starts out talking about the interesting but wild speculation. It's called The Fix, is the title of her piece. And there's a lot in it that I agree with. She starts out talking about what happens if one day George Bush gets on TV and says, well, we've just had, you know, a terrorist bomb went off in Baltimore. I think that was the scenario in, what was the movie, Bruce Willis movie, where they smuggled a nuclear weapon in a Coke machine and, you know, goes off in Baltimore, whatever it was. Anyway, you know, it's something like that. He says, well, a bomb just went off in, you know, fill in the blank name of city. Or anthrax was just attacked, whatever. And he says, and we're pretty sure that this all came from fill in the blank, you know, his axis of evil du jour, presumably a Muslim country. And therefore, we are not only attacking that country, but also that I am declaring a state of emergency, and we're going to suspend elections for 2008 for at least a year. And we are suspending habeas corpus in the United States, just like Abraham Lincoln did, and et cetera. And guess what? We're a police state. I mean, a real police state. We're down that road a ways right now, but this would be like flipping off the edge. And she lays out the scenario to make this sort of thing happen. And it's not an incredible scenario. It's a possible scenario. And I agree with her on this. It's a minimally possible, I would assign probably a less than 5 or 10% possibility to it, in large part because the media is now starting to push back against the Bush administration. But nonetheless, yeah, it's possible. But then she goes on to suggest that because, in her opinion, the likely nominee for the Democratic Party will be Hillary Clinton. I'm quoting now from Cindy's piece. She says, the likely nominee for the Democratic Party will be Hillary Clinton, a femme Bush, who has been virtually endorsed by George and accepts money from Rupert Murdoch, he of Fox News infamy, and who will soon own every newspaper and cable news network in the homeland. Well, you know, a little bit of hyperbole there, but, you know, we understand, Cindy. She says, I don't even want to discuss who is likely to be the Republican nominee because, you know, they're basically all the same. I mean, you know, other than Ron Paul, they're all pretty much taking the same position, and Ron Paul doesn't have a chance of being the Republican nominee. So basically, her conclusion, she says, the fix is in, folks. And then she says, the fix stopped Al Gore, who really won the 2000 election, from fighting for our country and our Constitution by supporting those congressional members who begged him through tears to sign on to continue the recount in Florida. Well, actually, since the last time we discussed that on this program, I've gone back and researched that. And had the Congressional Black Caucus had a member of the Senate signed on, and Al Gore felt it would be unseemly for him, but he could have easily said to Robert Byrd or somebody else, Barbara Boxer, somebody, you know, Russ Feingold, somebody who was friendly. He could have said, why don't you sign off on this thing? What that would have done under the Constitution, at least my understanding of it, is it would have thrown the election to the House of Representatives. And if that happened, the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives, the outcome would have been the same. And as Gore correctly pointed out, the Supreme Court had ruled, and really, when the Supreme Court has ruled, you've got nothing else other than revolution. And he was not prepared to lead a civil war against the United States. And frankly, he's gone on to do extraordinary things, and God bless him for it. But anyhow, Cindy suggests that the fix stopped Al Gore. I would say what stopped Al Gore was the fact that the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives at that point in time, which was in large part a consequence of Bill Clinton governing as Republican light rather than as a Democrat. That's why the Democrats lost the House during Bill Clinton's term of presidency, in my opinion. But that's, you know, kind of an aside. She says, the fix is why Kerry caved into George faster than anyone could say recount in 2004, breaking so many hearts and crushing so many hopes. I would submit respectfully that it wasn't the fix that caused Kerry to cave in. It was a character flaw in John Kerry, because John Edwards was strongly opposed to that, did not want Kerry to cave in, but he was not the presidential nominee. And Kerry should have fought that thing. And there are a lot of us, I would say probably most of us, who will not forget that and would never, ever again support John Kerry to run for president. She says, the fix is in compromised voting machines whose programs are written by the elite establishment. The fix is in the disenfranchisement, literally and spiritually, of hordes of voters who have seen their votes go uncounted for years and see their elected representatives ignore the will of their constituents. I would agree that we have a serious problem with our electronic voting machines. I've been talking about that for a long time on this program. I mean, it's you know, one of my big issues, that our voting has been handed off to private corporations. And we see the red shift in some states where the vote and the polls are different. Since 2000, it has become such a problem that the polling companies have basically all gone out of business. I'm not sure that it's entirely electronic voting machines, though. I agree with Cindy. I think the disenfranchisement is the biggest issue here, is Republican caging programs and other things. And the fact of the matter is that now that there's a Democratic majority in Congress, John Conyers is looking into this stuff. Henry Waxman is looking into this stuff. There are investigations underway. They need to get far more aggressive. There needs to be a lot more pushback. But nonetheless, I'm acknowledging that these are all problems. I am unwilling to acknowledge that this is a fix. I'm telling you, the Republicans in 1975 were as dispirited and despairing as the Democrats were after the election of 2004. I mean, they were there was talk after Ford lost the presidency to Jimmy Carter. There was talk about how the Republican Party should just pack up and go away. That it was dead forever. Well, tell that to, you know, Newt Gingrich 10 years ago. So anyhow, where Cindy wraps this thing up is she says, barring an electoral revolution of American citizens wanting to fix the fix by voting with our humanity, consciences, and integrity instead of out of fear that the greater criminal will win, we will be faced with two choices depending on one's perspective, evil or less evil. And then she says, I will break my hand, my voting hand, before I vote for Mr. or Ms. Lesser of Two Evils ever again. And I understand and respect that point of view. But let me submit to you, Cindy, and to everybody who's, I know that, you know, she's reflecting the sentiment of many people, many progressives, and frankly, many conservatives who are upset with the Republican candidates, that the solution isn't to not vote. That's what they want. You know, Paul Weyrich is the grand old man of this. What they want is for us not to vote. So, number one, the solution is not to vote. But number two, I would say that there's a third option between voting for the evil or the lesser of two evils, and that is to get involved. It's not enough anymore to just vote. And therefore, we shouldn't have our dialogue narrowly circumscribed, narrowly limited, put in this little box of who are we going to vote for, or are we going to refuse to vote, or are we going to vote for a third party. That should not be our dialogue. Our dialogue should be, what is the most effective way for us to organize to apply pressure on the Democratic Party to become the party of the people? Because it is not, to a large extent today, the party of the people. How do we apply pressure on whoever is the Democratic nominee to take positions and fight for them, and the Democrats in Congress to take positions and fight for them, so that we can truly return America to what it was before Ronald Reagan started unraveling it? Suggestions right after this break. 16 minutes. Back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
See, that's the key. It's the working together part. Our question for the hour, is cynicism, as expressed by Cindy Sheehan in the Fix piece that she wrote for Common Dreams yesterday, is cynicism becoming the Republicans' greatest friend? By the way, just a heads up, tomorrow, Friday, October 19th, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, the Discovery Channel is running an hour-long special on Who Killed Kennedy. In fact, it's titled Conspiracy Files, JFK Assassination. And I am about half of that, and you may find it very interesting. I think it's kind of cool. So you can check it out, Google it, listen to it, or TiVo it, or record it, or whatever. It's 1 o'clock Eastern time. It's while we're on the air, tomorrow on the Discovery Channel. So here's the problem. And it's, you know, it's laid out by Paul Weyrich. Paul Weyrich, the Republican strategist. This was maybe 10 years ago or so, talking to a group of Republicans in a church, a group of Christian Republican activists, about the need to discourage Democrats from voting.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So drive people away from the polls. Discourage them from voting. This is, frankly, it's one of the reasons why the Democrats have been so afraid to take on the issue of electronic voting machines possibly being rigged is because they're afraid that it'll cause people, I think incorrectly, this is where I absolutely disagree with Democratic strategy on this, but they believe that it's going to cause people to say, oh, it's already rigged, the machines are already fixed, I'm not going to bother voting. And then they won't show up to vote. And I think that, you know, the machines have significant flaws and they need to be done away with, frankly. We need just the whole idea of turning our elections over to private for-profit corporations is obscene in a democracy. The Netherlands, by the way, just turned down electronic voting. I told you last week, Ireland said no. Now Holland has said no. We will not have electronic voting machines, period. We're going to stay with paper. Canada said no a couple of years ago. They actually tried it in Quebec and said, this doesn't work. So the question is cynicism a disaster? And here's my solution. And it's what I mentioned at the tail end of the last hour. And that is that instead of talking about voting for the lesser of two evils or voting at all, what we need to be talking about is activism, getting active. How do we most effectively take control of a political party? The first, the most powerful lobbyist that a member of Congress, whether it's the House or the Senate, pays attention to is their state or local political party. It's their district political party in the case of members of the House of Representatives or the parties in the various counties that make up their district, and it is the state party that the senators pay attention to. That's the number one constituent that they are paying attention to. And I'm telling you, because it has been done in states in the United States, and in fact, the last chapter of my book, Screwed, I chronicle the stories of three people who actually did it. It is possible to take over a county or even a state party, even a Democratic party. Here's this giant machine that was founded by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, the longest lasting political party in the history of the world. This giant institution, this giant machine, it's like if I was to say, hey, let's take over Chrysler. There's no way you can do it. It's a corporation. It's worth billions of dollars, and the only way that you could take it over is to buy it. Period. You can't say, okay, we're going to get enough people to vote to take over. You can't do it. Or let's take over the pharmaceutical industry. You can't do it. But here is a political party, and it can be taken over, and in fact, it has been taken over. This is a political party that was controlled in its early days by both liberal Democrats, small d Democrats, and people who favored slavery. It was controlled by racists in the United States, in much of the South of the United States, up until the 1960s, when Lyndon Johnson was presented with civil rights legislation. Again, hearing the voice of the people, hearing the voice of the people who were active, not just the voters, the activists. When he was presented with us with the Civil Rights Act of 1967, and he was told by one of his advisors, sir, if you sign this bill, we will lose the Democratic Party in the South for a generation. And it was an absolutely accurate prophecy, because Nixon came along and said, oh, let's do the Southern strategy. Let's reach out to the white racists. And the Republican Party's primary base has been white racists ever since the early 70s. But LBJ said, no, the principle here is the most important thing. If losing the South is the price that the Democratic Party has to pay for doing the right thing, I'm willing to pay that price. And he took that principled position because the people were taking principled positions, not because Lyndon Johnson was a paragon of principle. Lyndon Johnson was a political hack to a large extent, particularly until he became president. But as president, he started paying attention to the people, with the exception of Vietnam, at least with these issues, with the issues of civil rights, and he had to do what was right. We have to organize. We have to get involved. We have to infiltrate and take over the Democratic Party.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
See, I absolutely understand this. I've been there. I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. I get it. No. Yes, it's Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Sort of. But it is, but it, to the extent that the Democratic and Republican parties share a corporatist agenda is the extent to which we have not been successful in being active enough taking these parties over. The Republican Party has always been the corporate party. Literally from their founding. And replacing the Whigs before them, replacing the Federalists before them, which was the first corporatist party. They have always been the power, the party of great wealth and power. And what they figured out in the 1970s was that that wasn't, well, actually in the election of 64, when Barry Goldwater went down in flames, what they figured out was being the party of wealth and power, being the party of economic conservatism, which benefits primarily the upper middle class and the rich, and the super rich, hugely, that was not enough. They had to broaden their base. They had to broaden their constituency. And so they said, who's out there that we can bring into the party? And Nixon said, well, let's bring the racists in the South in, the conservative, the not, they call themselves conservatives now. They used to call themselves Democrats. Let's bring in the white racists from the South. Let's bring in the homophobes, people who are afraid of gay people. Let's bring in the people who are the religious fanatics in this country. And with these little wedges, we can add them all up, and they will add up to enough to help us win elections. And you still have Republicans who are primarily corporatists, like Mitt Romney. I mean, the guy's a multimillionaire. He's all about the bucks. He's all about the benefits for wealthy people, sucking up to the religious right, to the homophobes, and to the racists. I mean, you know, it's just the Republican, and the good news is it's not working for the Republican Party anymore. Because people are figuring out, because 26 years of essentially Republican rule in the United States has destroyed the American middle class, and people are figuring it out. They're saying, enough already. We don't want it. And so the Republican Party is trying to figure out how to reinvent themselves, and they're having a terrible time because they got nothing except tax cuts for the rich, which is what they always had. It's all they've had for 200 years. Or since their founding, well, arguably, there was a brief period of time from 1856 when the Republican Party started their first convention in Jackson, Michigan, until the 1880s when they sold out to the robber barons. They were actually the party of abolition. They were actually a reform party. The Republican Party started as a reform party. So let's give them credit for the first 20 years, and then they sold out, and they've become the corporate. They've been the corporatist party ever since the mid-1880s. So I get that. The Democratic Party, however, has... It has had a checkered past as well. Obviously, it was the party of the slaveholders for a long time, but it's also been the party of the people for a long time, and particularly since the 1960s, when it totally repudiated its racist past. The Democratic Party is the party of the people. But we, the people, have failed to take it over and take it back. And that doesn't mean voting. It means getting active. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Wolf in Texas. Hey, Wolf, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I really thank you for the work you're doing. I wanted to bring up a quick comment regarding Cindy Sheehan. One of the things that I told your person who answered the phone was, I think there's healing to be found in the expression that Cindy made in her article. And I juxtapose that against the fact that if you bring up the subject of any of these issues with Nancy Pelosi, for example, who she's running against in the primaries, we're dismissed out of hand. We Democrats who are so frustrated are dismissed out of hand. And I think it's demonstrated the fact that Cindy's expressing sentiment that a lot of us have. But Cindy, of all people, has never given up. You're right when you said she's been to hell and back.
Yeah.
And she continues to fight the fight.
I'm not condemning her for this. I understand.
I didn't say you were, Tom. Okay. I'm just saying that I think it's nice to actually hear somebody who's expressing these feelings so eloquently, because I think she speaks for a lot of us. But we can't let cynicism rule the day. There's no doubt about that. You're absolutely right when you say it.
Yeah, and we the action that is required, what we have been taught, is that the action that's required is to vote. And I'm saying we live in a time, just as the Republicans figured out after the crash of 64, when the Goldwater went down in flames, they figured out that they lived in a time when just voting wasn't enough because there weren't enough voters and they couldn't activate them and they couldn't get them out there. And they had to reinvent their party. And actually, there was a group of people who said, you know, we're here. We'll help you. You know, and that was the Pat Robertson bunch and the Jerry Falwell bunch and the NRA bunch. And, you know, you add them all together and you've got this whole collection and the old KKK bunch. And they said, you know, we'll go with you. And people
right.
like Robert, you know, Robert Byrd had repudiated that and went to the and there's right across the board. The Democratic Party had walked away from that bunch and the Republicans said, hey, these guys don't have a home. Let's bring them in. And right now, we who don't have a home, progressives in the United States, people who believe in the historic progressive vision of the United States, I was going to say Democratic vision because it was Franklin Roosevelt's vision of the United States, and I believe to a large extent it was Jack Kennedy's vision of the United States, and even to a large extent Lyndon Johnson's vision and Jimmy Carter's vision of the United States,
absolutely,
but particularly Franklin Roosevelt. But it was also Teddy Roosevelt's vision of the United States, and he was a Republican. And that's why I call it the progressive vision, because there are a lot of Democrats who disagree with it, and there are some Republicans who actually would embrace it historically. And so we need to say we're going to go in and we're going to take over this party. And the only way to do that is, as I said, it's not the vote. It's to see, is to say, okay, one night a month, I'm going to show up for the party, or however often it happens. Or I'm going to join Jim Dean's organization, Democracy for America, which teaches people how to be activists and how to take over political parties and how to get out there and participate. And it's like $20 for a weekend workshop that is probably a better political education than you get if you had a bachelor's degree in political science. I mean, I've been there. I've been through the thing. I've taught part of it. I gave a speech at one of them. I mean, it's incredible what they're doing. And democracyforamerica.com. This is what we need. Well, thank you for your comment. It's you know, well said, and I think, you know, spot on. Mary in San Diego, listening on KLSD. Hey, Mary.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to reinforce what one of your previous callers said about the lobbyists, and I agree with him that they are getting the time, and our representatives are not listening to us. From August from 8:31 to 9:26, I made 68 calls to D.C., not just to my two senators and my one representative. I call anyone that I think will do anything, plus calling the president at least twice a week. And I just feel that they are not listening to us. I don't know what to do. I call constantly and reinforce what I've said in the past, but it just doesn't seem to register with them.
Trust me, it is, Mary. And
pardon?
Trust me, it is. We may be. I don't think that we are this far out, but we may be at a position that is not unlike the position that Susan B. Anthony was in 1872, when she and Mary Stanton, Katie, was it, as I recall, I'm forgetting
yes.
her name, her compatriot, were, you know, arrested for illegally voting. And, you know, she did not live to see women get the vote. But she laid the foundation.
We have to vote.
No, but my point is that most movements take more than just 1 year or more than just 2 years or more than just an election cycle. But you don't give up. You don't stop. And what you are doing is so great. And I so honor you for that, Mary. And I beg you to please keep making those calls.
I will.
And keep participating. Good on you. Good on
I
you.
I will. But I just feel I'm talking to a blank wall.
Well, I know that it feels that way from time to time, but you have to recalibrate that feeling and just say, you know, sometimes if you hit the wall hard enough, often enough, long enough, the wall will begin to crack. And that's what will happen. Mary, thank you so much
I'll
for the call
trying.
And for your
thank
activism.
You for what you do.
You're welcome, and the same to you. It is much appreciated. Leanda in Tucson, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Leanda.
Hi, Tom. What a privilege it is to speak to you. I really see you as a modern-day Renaissance man, and I've read most of your books. So.
Oh, well, thank you.
Boy, I'm having some difficulty hearing you. Okay. Now you are asking for suggestions, and having run for city council in Tucson, and being an activist in election integrity, and Arizona really is leading the country with what we're doing here, I do have a number of suggestions about how to deal with the hypocrites in the corporate millionaires club that I call Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we have to remember is that it was not Congress that got rid of Nixon. It was the media. And as you speak of frequently, you know that the media was intended to be the fourth check and balance on the government.
Right, the fourth estate. It's why it's the only industry that's written into the Constitution.
Right. Well, what's happening with the media now with the consolidation? This is just another step into fascism. And we have to let the media know, because I think the media is more responsive to us than Congress, because they know that they will be put into position by the corporate money that's buying them because of this flawed Supreme Court that equates money with speech, which is it's a total fallacy.
Yeah.
But what I've been suggesting here in Tucson and for around the country...
Leander, we have to take a break, and you've really been doing the work on the ground, and I'd like to hear your second point. Can you stick around right over the break?
Absolutely.
Hang on. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com for our website. You want to see a great little squirrel video? It's up at the top. Speaking of squirrels, yesterday or the day before. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Chasing the dream of democracy here, 9 minutes before the hour. We were talking with Leander from Tucson. Leander, you've run for city council. You've run for elected office. You've been involved in politics. You were making, and you live in a state, one of two states in the United States, that has voter-owned elections to a large extent, not unlike we do here in the city of Portland. So you had a couple of suggestions for people who want to get active, and we need to do it fairly quickly because we've got a whole bunch of other people who want to get in here and
okay, what I would say, first of all, is that instead of just protesting in parks, what we have to do is protest in front of media outlets. So they have to step over us to ignore us.
Good suggestion.
Okay. I think that everyone for Halloween should put up symbols of true evil, and instead of ghouls, we should be putting up images of Bush and Cheney and their cabal with blood dripping from their hands.
Yeah, although let's also remember that Bush and Cheney are not running for re-election. This is a Republican war, not just a Bush and Cheney war.
Well, you know, in terms of who's running, we have a one-party system right now. And just look at Hillary Clinton. She is not a Democrat, as I think of Democrats. We need a two-party system.
Yeah.
And
well, and that's
over is going to be very difficult because the progressives, and I count myself proudly as a progressive, we have been working and working, and they keep pushing back on us because of the money in politics.
No, I understand, and that's why we need to keep working even more aggressively. You know, it's and Leander, thank you very much for sharing that with us. One of our listeners sent me a copy of a fall 1932 edition of the Saturday Evening Post. The publication founded on the masthead says founded by Ben Franklin, and it was the vice presidential candidate, Franklin Roosevelt's vice presidential candidate, giving the pitch for why you should vote for Franklin Roosevelt in the election that was going to happen in about 6 or 8 weeks. And he was talking about micro-adjusting tariffs. I'm serious. He was talking about adjusting tariffs. Franklin Roosevelt did not run as a progressive who was going to put into place Social Security and who was going to put into place the Wagner Act and legalize and put the force of law behind, in fact, the existence of unions. He did not run on that platform. He ran on a platform that was a very modest, very moderate, essentially a Hillary Clinton-esque platform that would appeal, in his opinion, to the largest majority of Americans. But that's not how he governed. Now, on the other hand, you have Bill Clinton, who in 1992 ran on a very progressive platform and was elected based on that because people liked that, and then governed as a moderate or as a Republican light. And as a result, Democrats lost the House of Representatives. We have to help the Democratic Party figure out that not only is its base progressives, but most of America, when presented with the real issues, is progressive. We need to work to get the money out of politics so that every state can be like Arizona and every city can be like Portland and have voter-owned elections and get involved. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. As someone who has gotten involved, it's, I know all the frustration, you know, working your buns off, working all night. And like I, one of the key things I had worked on is the Democratic Party platform in the last election.
Yeah, well, how did you get started in all this? My recollection, Jeff, is that 5 years ago you were calling this show saying that we should all be voting for Al Gore. For Ralph Nader.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, in many ways, I still believe that. But what I see here, I'll tell you how I got involved and tell you, but give me an analogy first. I see basically there are two vehicles that can get us to the presidency, Democrats and Republicans. They're like cars, but they've got lousy passengers. The Green Party may have great passengers, but it's a lousy vehicle. You can't get there. So what we need to do is bring in the Green Party to become voting blocks within the Democrats, to become power blocks and so forth.
Amen.
And all I did, I mean, if you were just to see at every level of the party, you'd be going to a caucus meeting. You know, for me, it's like start off with going to caucus, becoming a representative there, then going to, you know, district meetings, you have county meetings and so forth. And each time just saying, oh, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, at one point I got involved, you know, became part of the platform committee meeting. And if you look at the Colorado platform in the 2006, much of what you see, especially the front, was actually my wording.
So you, a progressive who was a Green, who was 5 years ago saying there's no difference between the Republicans and Democrats, to hell with the Democratic Party, you have infiltrated and taken over your part of the Democratic Party to the point that you've changed the party platform.
No, I would not even remotely say taken over. We're
influenced it.
The thing is, well, there's a lot of placebo stuff. You can do a hell of a lot of work, but you may not have any influence.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got it. What I recommend is people, you know, like if you saw how much time is wasted just arguing bylaws.
Sure.
At every meeting, people make a great proposal and say, well, the bylaws don't allow this. And you waste more time arguing about stuff like this. What I'm the Democratic Party needs.
I remember SDS meetings being like that in the 1970s.
Yeah.
The 1960s, excuse me.
What the Democratic Party needs is organization. They have no clue how to use computers, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, there were meeting times people say, well, I never got noticed this meeting and so forth. They need people who are good communicators, who are good organizers to come in and really communicate within there. And the other thing that people need to do that can be very effective is meet face-to-face with your representative and or their assistants.
Diminish their assistants. If you get relegated to an assistant, that still is going to have significant consequence. In fact, very often the assistants are the ones who are making some of the decisions.
Which brings up the other point, as I've suggested on the show before. A lot of us could become their assistants. Hey, you can get paid to do the research and communicate with the representative. You don't have to become the congressperson. You don't have to become the city council person, but you can be their office person. You can be their assistant.
Wow,
and it's a great way to have influence.
That's worthy of Trotsky.
But, yeah, there are all these ways we can penetrate. Yeah, I'm frustrated as hell. I mean, as I said, I put in incredible work where you just get ignored. Mm-hmm. And I backed off for the moment, but coming back, but not to back off to flee, but to come back in much stronger.
Yeah.
But
and bring your friends.
Yeah, and the thing is, talk to people who've already been in there. Learn where the dead ends are, because there are things where you can do work. They said they're placebo. But, like, learn the bylaws, learn the rules, and come in with things in writing. So when you come into a meeting, have your stuff all on pieces of paper that everybody else can read.
Yeah.
Well, and that will be much more effective, because if you have to keep writing down these handwritten notes, it gets nowhere.
Great. Jeff, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you for your activism. Thank you for your service to our country. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's what it really and truly is. 57 minutes past the hour. Peter Phyllis, Project Censored, coming up next.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. Well, they just had the vote in the House of Representatives. In fact, Adam in New York City, you just called to tell us about it. I'm seeing it here on the news. On the S-CHIP. This is on the Children's Health Insurance Program. Adam, you're on the air.
Yes, most people, I don't know, I work from home, so I watch C-SPAN, and they just didn't turn the veto over. I think 176 Republicans voted not to turn it over. And I was just curious, what organization do you think might be good to contact to maybe place an ad in papers across the country just stating these are the members of Congress that voted against turning over Bush's veto on S-CHIP or funding, however they want to word it, just thought you should know, something simple like that.
Yeah, my guess is that one of the major progressive organizations is going to pick this thing up, whether it's Think Progress, whether it's MoveOn.org, whether it's, you know, one of the other groups, Democrats.org or Democrats.com, I think it is. I'm not sure right now. I would suggest you might want to call. If you have a Democratic member of the House or Senate, you might want to call their office and ask them that question.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot, Adam. And Adam is right. The House today failed to override President Bush's S-CHIP veto. They fell short by 13 votes. The final roll call, 273 to 156. They actually picked up 8 voters. They picked up 8 Republicans. But they needed another 13. Dana Perino, the White House press secretary, says, we won this round on S-CHIP. Now, isn't that marvelous? So, Rahm Emanuel, not my favorite Democrat, but, you know, a reasonably decent guy, the Democrat from Illinois. My objection to Rahm has to do with his DLC, his having headed up the DLC. But in any case, Rahm Emanuel says, in the coming days, Democrats will not back down, and we will insist on providing health care coverage to these 10 million children. Good on you, Rahm. In other news, Mike Mukasey, the guy who, the man who would be our attorney general, today, being questioned by Sheldon Whitehouse, the Democrat from Rhode Island, was not willing to say waterboarding is torture. That's disappointing. I mean, you know, speaking of disappointing stuff. Peter Phillips is with us from the Project Censored organization, projectcensored.org. He's a professor of sociology at Sonoma State University and director of the Project Censored Project. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. Two things I want to talk with you about very quickly. The first, this new research study, you and Bridget Thornton writing about this, completed at your university about how health and disability insurance companies are systematically cheating the American public. Give us the inside dope on this.
Well, this is a new study that we worked 9 months on, funded by Just Health, a nonprofit advocacy organization here in Northern California. And the title of the study is Practices in Healthcare and Disability Insurance: Delay, Diminish, Deny, and Blame. And we've taken a look at the top insurance companies. We interviewed 20 people from 7 different insurance companies that had major problems. And systematically, their claims were delayed, their services, they diminished what they were getting in terms of medical care, and or they were all outright denied. And some of them fought for years. And these are just the people that fight and appeal or get attorneys. I mean, thousands and thousands of people around the country experience the same thing, and they just give up.
Yeah.
So we have a healthcare system that's making profits for these giant corporations, $92 billion last year in profits among the top 9 corporations. So we're talking people here like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, Berkshire Hathaway. They made, you know, $11 billion profit last year, and this is out of our healthcare dollars.
Yeah.
So we got insurance companies.
Well, United Healthcare paid Bill McGuire, their CEO, $1.7 billion in compensation over the last decade.
Exactly. So we have insurance companies are the middlemen. They keep patients from doctors.
Right. And I have a family member, and tell me if this is typical. I have a family member who a little more than a decade and a half ago developed failure of the thyroid, you know, and has to take what is the most commonly prescribed drug in America, Synthroid, which is a drug that's basically a replacement for one of the hormones that the thyroid produces. Literally, this is the most commonly prescribed drug in America. There's an epidemic of this among women, and a lot of speculation about why. Is it related to nuclear tests in the 50s and 60s or what? Nobody knows. But in any case, every 3 months she has to go back to the doctor, or at the very least call the doctor to get the prescription renewed, and every month the prescription has to be refilled. And every time either one of those events happens and the bill is submitted to the insurance company sends us a letter saying, if you don't call us and confirm that this is actually your bill, we're not going to pay it. So we have to jump through all these hoops, and then some of the time they don't pay it anyway.
That's exactly what happens. We talk to insiders inside the insurance companies, and they say claims processors are ordered to deny a set of dollars each month, and if their target is not achieved, they lose their job. So they, inside, they get rewarded for denying claims. I mean, this is the structure of private insurance, health insurance in the United States.
This is for-profit health insurance, whereas the guys who work in the Social Security office or the Medicare office, they get to keep their jobs if they do a good job of making sure that the checks are cut correctly, accurately, and without fraud.
Exactly. I mean, we spend more on health care in the United States than per capita than any other nation in the world,
yeah.
And we get less.
Yeah, this is incredible. This is a great story. You can find it over at projectcensored.org. Peter, in the 2 or 3 minutes we have left, let's talk about Project Censored. You just issued your new list of winners of the Project Censored Award. Tell us what the award is and what's going on here.
Well, there's a book, Censored 2008, which is out, and we list 25 most important news stories the corporate media has not covered. And there's 200 of us at the university who do this research every year. It's a year-long project, and we're saying to the corporate media, you're not telling us the important things that powerful people are doing that affect all of our lives. And the number one story, which we're proud to say Tom Hartman is one of the winners, is about habeas corpus and how they changed the law so the president can put you in jail and leave you there indefinitely.
Forever. Without ever even being charged with a crime. And this is a law that goes back to 1215 when King John was confronted by the feudal lords at the Plain of Runnymede in northern England. And it's just incredible. But anyway, some of the other Project Censored winners as well, some of the other stories that...
Well, the mass arrest practices that are going on under the Justice Department where they're coordinating 960 agencies, federal, state, and local, to arrest simultaneously 10,000 people. They've done this three times now. Halliburton's building detention centers and expanding them around the country. We've got easier martial law implications because of the Warner Defense Act last year allows the president to nationalize the guard in any state over the objections of the governor for any emergency the president thinks necessary. A lot of really powerful civil liberty stories this year, which we're featuring in our media accountability conference on October 26th and 7th at Sonoma State University, where you and many of the other authors will be present for a two-day conference.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And people can learn about that also at projectcensored.org. And you're going to have workshops, you're going to have speeches. I shouldn't be telling you. You tell us about it.
Well, we've got civil liberties workshops, and then on Saturday, a number of different, all the award winners, we have a ceremony luncheon, and you're speaking at 4 o'clock that afternoon. And we're opening that up to the entire campus, and people will be coming in from all over the area.
Yeah, it should be good. It should be a lot of fun. And now you've been doing this. Project Censored has been awarding these Project Censored Awards for how long?
31 years.
31 years.
Years here at Sonoma State.
Wow.
And
wow. In retrospect, have any of the stories that you have given Project Censored Awards to broken out of the status of ignored and become mainstream stories?
Well, about one out of three have ended up making national coverage, but it seems that since 9/11 that doesn't seem that it's as strong. The media is so consolidated now that many of these stories just never see the light of day.
Yeah, and not just consolidated, so wimpish. So, and in large part, I think this is because you've got people controlling the media gates that have become stars. They have multi-$100,000 or million-dollar salaries, and they don't want to risk their livelihood.
Well, that and the corporate media is principally in the entertainment business.
Yeah.
So, you know, Paris Hilton, when she went to jail, Fox had 56 headlines in 3 weeks about Paris Hilton and ignores all these other important stories.
Right, and completely ignores things like the loss of habeas corpus. Peter Phillips, he's the professor of sociology at Sonoma State University, director of the Project Censored Project, director of Project Censored, at the website projectcensored.org, and the weekend after this, I'll be down there. Show up. Be there, be square. Peter, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
And thanks for the honor of winning the first prize there. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Yes, if you want to, you got to.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The congressman, the contractor, and the hookers. Christy Harvey is with us. Boy, that was a lousy segue. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress to tell us about the congressman, the contractor, and the hookers. Hey, Christy.
Hey, how are you doing?
Just great. And it's always wonderful to have you on the program with us. Thank you. Thank you for being here. I understand that this is one of the stories you think is flying below the radar that we really should be paying attention to.
It is. Plus, you know, it's always sort of fun to catch the high-up lawmakers doing bad and dirty things, I think. So, the testimony or the trial started this week for Brent Wilkes. And you remember Brent Wilkes was the defense contractor who was accused of giving Duke Cunningham $700,000 in bribes and boats and hookers.
Yeah, he was the guy who bought the Dukester, wasn't he? The boat for Duke?
I believe he was. But he did all of this in exchange for $80 million in defense contracts. So, you know, he got what he paid for.
Boy, a good investment. Invest less than $1 million and get $80 million back? Wow.
Isn't that smart?
Yes.
Duke Cunningham is already in trouble, and he is looking at 8 years in jail, and he has to pay $1.8 million back for restitution. But Brent Wilkes' trial started this week, and yesterday they called to the stand two of the hookers who were involved with Duke Cunningham and Brent Wilkes during one of their big party sessions down in Hawaii.
Oh, interesting.
It was very interesting. One of the hookers testified that Duke Cunningham fed her grapes while she sat in the hot tub, which for some reason really skeeved me out.
That's strange. I mean, the picture that comes to mind, not of that, I'm not even going to let myself make that picture, but when you talk about, you know, feeding people grapes, I mean, you think of the old classic Greek imagery where usually in the stereotype and obviously the sexism of 3,000 years ago, it was the woman feeding the man grapes. In this case, it was Duke Cunningham feeding grapes to the woman?
Absolutely, yes.
How interesting. Well, maybe he's very progressive in his views on women's liberation.
Somehow I'm not.
You're not going to buy that one.
But then it turns out they knew that after this party weekend happened, things cooled off a little bit between Duke Cunningham and Brent Wilkes, and they had in part brought the prostitutes in to see what they knew about that cool off. And it turns out that Duke Cunningham and his number one briber, Brent Wilkes, got in a huge fight that night over which one got to go upstairs with the prettier hooker. Classy stuff here.
You're
kidding. And they had a knockdown drag out about who got the pretty one, and Brent Wilkes won because, you know, he's the one footing the bills. And I guess Duke Cunningham carried a grudge.
That's incredible. So this guy is willing to give Cunningham $700,000. Cunningham's willing to give him $84 million in defense contracts.
Uh-huh.
We're talking huge money, and they're fighting over a woman who cost how much for that night?
$300 a night.
$300. I'm sorry, I realize that even to have this conversation at a certain level suggests that both of us are discussing women as a commodity. But in this case, the women were at least providing their services as a commodity, and the men were buying them. And frankly, I think that should be legal, but that's a whole other thing. This is bizarre. What a lack of judgment.
Just how petty they got, and what immature, and, you know, who fights like that? That's just disgusting, especially when you think about it. I mean, people need to remember every once in a while, Duke Cunningham was the inspiration for the Tom Cruise character in Top Gun.
Jeez.
That story was based on Duke Cunningham's life. So all I can say is I can't wait for Top Gun 2 Electric Boogaloo. I mean, this is...
Or Hooker Boogaloo, right? Now,
Boogaloo.
Did the hooker testify as to whether or not she was tipped well by Mr. Cunningham, who got $700,000 for his efforts?
She actually did. She said that Duke Cunningham tipped her between somewhere between $50 and $80.
No, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing in the world of $300 a night hookers. Did she express an opinion?
She didn't, and I don't really know. You know, yeah. All of my
we're both unqualified to
pretty woman.
Right, we're both unqualified to know the answer to that. Fortunately, it's anything else flying under the radar? We have about a half a minute left here, Christy. That you think we should be knowing about and talking about?
Well, the Hill newspaper, I thought, was pretty funny. After Larry Craig this week came out and talked to Matt Lauer, the Hill newspaper here in Washington realized you could have a really great Larry Craig Halloween costume.
Oh, jeez.
All you need is to attach a knife handle to your back with the letters GOP on it, wear tap shoes, and carry a roll of toilet paper.
Right. Or put bus tracks up and down your back and put Mitt Romney's name on there. Now, here's the thing that I have not seen anybody do in the media, and that is there's 80 bathrooms in the Minneapolis airport.
Uh-huh.
Why hasn't anybody looked at what gate his flight came in from, what gate his flight went out on, and discovered whether or not the bathroom that he was busted in, because there are two bathrooms that are notorious for this gay sex problem, apparently they're in very remote places, and probably were not between these two gates. Why has nobody mentioned that?
Oh, that's genius. We need to get an investigative reporter on that now.
Just get a map of the airport. I mean, it's so simple. Yeah. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Thanks, Christy.
Thanks a lot.
27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
It's the best of the rest of the news. It's that time every week when we sit down with a few folks from the tubes, not the trucks, the internets, and ask what's going on out there. What are the big stories? What are the stories that we should be paying attention to? We might be missing. What are the stories that are making their way flying around in the electrons of the tubes of the internets? And Matt Stoller is with us. He is a political activist and blogger in Washington, D.C. He was an editor at MyDD and is now with OpenLeft.com. And Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
Great to have you here with us. Also, we have with us Nancy Scola. Nancy Scola is the official blogger at AirAmerica.com, and she has her blog on our homepage, AirAmerica.com, every day. Hey, Nancy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And great to have you in the studio there in New York. And it sounds like you're right here in Portland.
Great.
Matt, let me go with you first, if you don't mind. What do you see as the biggest stories over at OpenLeft.com? What's the stuff that's really hot on the web right now?
Well, so much. I think that probably the biggest sort of story of the moment is the retroactive immunity for the telecom companies.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that they've been spying. Government asked them to spy on Americans and, you know, AT&T, Verizon, et cetera, and they chose to do that. And
with the exception of Quest, was it not?
It was before 9/11.
Right.
They started to do it.
Yeah.
And which was just clearly illegal. They knew it was illegal. And Quest didn't do it and was blocked in its merger plans, and the CEO was eventually convicted of insider trading.
Right.
I mean, you know, you can sort of color, you know, you sort of draw the dots together if you want to.
Isn't it amazing that the mainstream media has...
Senate, the big news is that the Senate is considering giving these companies retroactive immunity for their law breaking. And it's just kind of like, what can you do? It's just sort of a joke.
Yeah, but isn't it amazing that the mainstream media has, by and large, completely ignored the connecting dots part of this? I mean, the only really serious and competent reporting that I've seen on this story on television was by Keith Olbermann. That was it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, the media is just corrupt. That's true.
Yeah, is it corrupt or has it been corrupted by big money? It's a good question. Nancy Scola over at AirAmerica.com, what are the big stories that you're blogging about and that you're, from our listeners right across the board on Air America, are responding to?
Well, Tom, you know, I always like to bring you the most obscure story I possibly can, and I think I succeeded today. So the one that I'm focused on right now is that the World Bank's internal auditors said this week that the bank's conservative economic approach to agriculture in Africa has failed and failed miserably. which is sort of interesting because during the 90s, the 80s and the 90s, the World Bank introduced what amounted pretty much to Reaganomics in Africa. They deregulated industry, they opened up free markets, they privatized government services. And the idea, of course, was sort of this, you know, conservative approach that market forces would step into the breach. And what the World Bank auditor said this week was that just didn't happen in any way.
That's interesting, because the World Bank has been pushing this ever since Pinochet, was overthrew Allende in Chile. I mean, this is something that goes back to the 70s.
Yeah, absolutely. And Bob Zoellick, who was actually, as we know, the U.S. Trade Representative in the Bush administration a while back, is now the head of the bank, of course. And his response was interesting. He pretty much said, yes, that's what happened. These conservative approaches, the privatized deregulation approach in Africa just completely failed.
This is the failure of what everybody in the world calls neoliberalism, except us in the United States, because nobody in the United States knows what that word means. We call it conservative economic policies or Reaganomics and whatnot. That's fascinating, Nancy. I'm assuming that it has not been picked up by the mainstream media. This is nothing that is being talked about.
No, it was a report that came out this week. There was one short story in the New York Times, I believe, and beyond that, no, there's been no coverage.
Amazing. This is the failure of Friedmanism, both Tom and Milton. This is the failure of Reaganism, of Reaganomics. This is the failure of Thatcherism. This is the failure. That's great. That's great. Matt, what else are you seeing over there at OpenLeft.com? What are the other stories that you're noticing?
Well, you know, Chris Dodd came out and put a hold on the telecom immunity bill. It's kind of good. I don't know. Colin Peterson, who's the chair of the Agriculture Committee, Democrat, said that people are dumb if they overpay and buy organic or local food. Let me see here. Hillary,
I guess nobody in his family ever experienced cancer.
Yeah, it's cool to get poisoned. We just lost the vote on S-CHIP. There's probably more bad things that have happened. I don't know. I'm just kind of... there's a big cap and trade bill coming through that's like a $200 billion giveaway to coal. I'm just trying to find more stuff.
That's quite all right. And Nancy, I'm curious, Nancy Scola, what else are you seeing over at AirAmerica.com?
Well, something that hasn't popped up on AirAmerica.com yet, but something I would really like to talk about, and I think I'll be blogging about today and tomorrow, is this big, big fight in Congress over a bill that would ban workplace discrimination against employees that are gay, lesbian, and bisexual. But as the bill stands now, it doesn't exclude discrimination on for people that are transgender.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the major gay rights groups, like the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, are angry that transgender and really any reference to gender identity has been dropped from the bill. And interestingly enough, it was actually dropped from the bill by Barney Frank from Massachusetts, who, as we all know, is one of the few openly gay congressmen.
Yeah, I saw a story about this over at Common Dreams.
Yeah.
The T in GLBT is being dropped, why is it? Because transgendered people are a significant minority even within the gay community, or actually, some would argue that they're not part of the gay community, that they're just part of the non-quote mainstream heterosexual community, I guess.
Yeah,
we have to understand that they don't deserve rights. I mean, that's the reality. They don't deserve rights.
Yeah.
Say what, Matt? Are you saying that as a statement of belief, or or ironically?
I don't know at this point.
Well, the supporters of the bill, like Rep. Frank, are saying that there's just no way to pass a bill with transgender language through Congress the way that the Congress is today. And what groups like the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, Lambda Legal, are saying is we can't leave people behind from this movement just because it's politically expedient. And this would be the same as sort of in the civil rights movement, differentiating between which groups can be discriminated against and not. So they said, the argument is sort of all or nothing for supporters of inclusive transgender language.
Right.
And then there are people that are making the political calculation that it's just not going to pass with any reference to transgender in 2007.
Yeah, you wanted to say something.
Light-skinned blacks deserve full rights, and dark-skinned blacks don't. That's sort of
it. It is a little, yeah, that is the distinction.
You know, what's really ironic is I believe it's South Africa. We talked about this a week or so ago on this program. I may be wrong, but I believe it's South Africa, where it's illegal to be gay, but the government will pay for a sex change operation. In other words, they endorse the idea of being transgendered.
Yeah, Iran. It's actually Iran, which is interesting.
Iran.
Yes.
Yeah,
and
thank
they have
you.
The second largest population of transgendered citizens after Thailand in Iran.
I don't think it's illegal to be gay. I just don't think there are any people who are gay. That's what Amit Dhinder said.
That
yes.
works out well.
Yeah, and he would never lie to us. He would never lie
I think
to
you,
us.
Could, you guys are being unfair to Amit Dhinder.
It was actually yeah. interesting that the some segment of the Iranian government came out and said, oh, that was a misunderstanding. We have gay people. We just don't have that many of them. And I thought that was an interesting clarification for them to make.
Yeah. Yeah, they try to correct it. So, yeah, and Matt, if you're on a speakerphone, you need to pick up the phone. Nancy, what are you seeing that might be flying under the radar? I know you started out with the World Bank story that sort of fell into that category, but what are the other stories that perhaps in the future we're going to see as big stories but aren't right now?
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to turn into a big story, but I think it deserves to be, and that's the journalist shield law that's going through Congress right now. And that extends shield law privileges to working journalists so that they don't have to reveal confidential sources in many cases. In many cases, they still do have to. And the way that the journalist has been defined in there is sort of, you know, it applies to a world of journalism circa 1997 and not 2007. And that's that people have to qualify as a journalist under the law, you have to you have to earn a considerable amount of income from your journalistic endeavors. So there hasn't been that much discussion about that, frankly, that it's leaving, obviously, a fair number of bloggers and citizen journalists behind.
And people who are working for nonprofit organizations and small local media.
Yeah, which is where a lot of investigative newspapers. Journalism is going these days.
A lot
the
of
foundations
stories.
Onto the smaller media.
Yeah, a lot of stories are broken. At least here in Portland, I can tell you, a lot of stories are broken by some of the smaller local newspapers that, you know, don't pay enormous salaries. In fact, you're a part-time stringer or you sell a story based on, you know, a word count or something like that.
Yeah.
And these people would not be covered under this bill. That's a shame.
It's sort of interesting. It's a similar argument to the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and that's that this is what's feasible at this point. This is a bill that we can get through. And I actually found an interesting statistic today when I was doing a little bit of research, and that's there's been 100 attempts to pass a shield law in the United States Congress in the last 30 years, and this is when we can actually get done. So it might not be go the whole way that we want to go, but it'll at least go part of the way.
Yeah, so it's a step in the right direction. Do you think it's going to pass?
I believe it will likely pass the House. It's already passed the House and likely passed the Senate, but Bush has promised to veto.
He has already in advance said he'll veto.
Yeah, it's a national security concern.
These guys are...
I mean, frankly, the you know, who cares? I mean, honestly, like...
Well, I do.
Who cares? Why does the press deserve any special protections?
Because the press is because the press is what keeps us safe from the government. This is why the press was carved out as the only industry to be protected specifically in the First Amendment in the
doesn't.
Constitution.
But this press doesn't.
Well, I don't disagree with you there, Matt, but I really think that we need to acknowledge that the press is the one industry that the founders chose to put into the Constitution and that there's a reason for it. Matt Stoller, openleft.com, Nancy Scola, airamerica.com. Thank you both for being with us today. Good talking with you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
And I'm taking my country back. Boys, you ain't been doing it right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them over. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here, taking our country back. Noon to 3 Eastern Time, 9 to noon Pacific Time. Tom Hartman with you. Just a tip of the hat to Bob Agnew. Who runs KGRN in San Francisco, one of the finest cities in America, who just sent me the men's rules. Yeah, a little dizzy here. Whenever possible, please say whatever you have to say during commercials. Christopher Columbus did not need directions, and neither do we. If we ask what is wrong and you say nothing, we will act like nothing's wrong. Yeah, some of the... These are, by the way, vetted by my wife. She says these are... Yes and no are perfectly acceptable answers to almost every question. Ah, yes, rules for men. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, a lot going on in Washington, D.C. today.
an absolute lot. The S-CHIP failed by 13 votes, actually, to override the president's veto. Two Democrats voted with the Republicans, including a guy from our Mississippi district, Gene Taylor, who I actually just had about a half-hour phone conversation, a person-to-person conversation with last night, although the S-CHIP didn't come up because it never dawned on me that he was going to vote against the Democrats on that one. Meanwhile, Denny Hastert says that he is going to probably resign early. He is going to resign early. And what's so fascinating about the Denny Hastert situation is that he essentially went on a golf outing in Palm Springs, and then he went back and forth to private jets to this. Well, you know, this is the exact same kind of thing that they accused Bob Ney of and put him in jail for it. So I think a lot of this is heating up, and he knows that.
Yeah, as soon as you said Denny Hastert is going to resign early, Mike, I almost interrupted you and said, oh, what crime has he committed? What is he being investigated for? Interesting. Do you think that he's resigning in the hopes to head off the investigation, that they'll just give up since he's no longer a member of Congress?
I'm not clear. I mean, the investigation would still happen from the Justice Department, although there may have been a private deal made with the Justice Department. Get out of your seat and we won't prosecute. It certainly will get away from the Ethics Department at Congress.
Right, which is where a lot of stuff may come out.
Right.
And has in the past. I understand Alberto Gonzalez was investigating subordinates who were likely to testify against him. That's the headline over at the Huffington Post. Do you have the story on this?
Well, I don't really have the story on it. There was, in fact, some rumor about that, actually, a little while ago, that this was, that he wasn't necessarily an investigation, but there was pressure being put on by people in the Justice Department. So this is not a new story. They may have more evidence at this point, but not a new story. Something else very disturbing to me, and that is that Iraq is apparently giving some private sector companies in China and Iran some contracts. The White House would say that these contracts are under discussion about future investment, and all of a sudden, Dana Perino is saying that Iraq is a sovereign country. Now, earlier this morning, the Iraqi Prime Minister's spokesperson was at the White House, did the morning gaggle, not on camera with us, and basically I asked him about the fact that wasn't the insurgency getting more clever? They weren't killing as many people, but they were getting more clever in terms of who they were killing. And he simply said, well, the insurgency is moving towards Mosul, Iraq. I mean, he completely avoided the question.
Interesting. But China and Iran may be investing in Iraq.
That's right.
That's fascinating.
Not just investment, but contracts with the Iraqi government.
Right. Oh, even more interesting. I'm curious.
Tax dollars at work, Tom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, since most of the Iraqi government is being propped up with our tax dollars. What is your take on what's going on with Mr. Mukasey? He's on the one hand, he seems to be saying the right thing. You know, we won't sanction torture. It's un-American. On the other hand, today Sheldon Whitehouse asked him, okay, is waterboarding torture? And he refused to give a straight answer.
Well, that's right. I mean, he refused to say whether it's torture or not. He said essentially if it had been defined as torture, then he was against it. But he would not commit to that in any way, shape, or form. And, I mean, I got to tell you, he's very clever politically. Or he wouldn't be there in the first place, but he's maybe more clever and more wily than we expected.
So do we have another Scalia, Alito, you know, kind of situation here where somebody, or probably Roberts actually is a better example. Somebody talks a good line, but then when they get in, you discover that, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think he is talking a good line, and clearly the Democrats have decided that this is not, in terms of picking their battles, this is not a battle they particularly want to have.
Yeah. So he's going to be the Attorney General.
Well, the other option is, of course, the president could have made an interim appointment. So clearly there was some, you know, you let him testify before Congress. We'll approve it, and, you know, you look like you've got your nominee approved. There's not going to be a fight because it's an interim appointment. That's the kind of thing.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of people are also saying, you know, it's only 459 days, 9 hours, 57 minutes, and 12 seconds until this nightmare is over. So what else is going on?
Okay, a couple other interesting items here. There was a Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, Stuart Bowen. He issued a report today, and he is now saying that they're making incremental progress in reconstruction. However, he said because of the political and ethnic conflicts, as well as the security situation, that they're having a lot of trouble with that. And one other interesting thing, Army Deputy Chief of Staff Michael Rochelle said today that they're going to have to probably use stop loss. They won't let gays in the military. They're recruiting from jails, but they're going to have to use stop loss in order to keep Iraq in hoops.
Amazing. Tragic. Ellen Radner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. Bernie Sanders. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. I'll also be debating David Horowitz on his suggestion that we should have, well, actually he's doing it. It is Islamofascism Awareness Week on campuses all across the country. That and your calls on our program. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Talk to you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.